has an axis around the x-axis. You try to turn
it. Word. Word. Oh, yeah. Oh, no. What's popping out here? Oh, no. Say word. Say word. Say word. Oh, yeah. Passing the copia. Passing the copia.
So because of Newton's third law, every action has a reaction of equal magnitude. In the process of you trying to speed up the axis around, you're trying to speed up the x-axis, your whole spacecraft, your Hubble spacecraft, will rotate in the opposite direction around the x-axis. Or conversely, if you try to slow it down, you'll rotate in the other direction around the x-axis. So if you've got three of these inertial wheels on the Hubble Space Telescope, by speeding them up and slowing them down, you can now completely steer the Hubble at any point you want in three-dimensional space without using rocket power. You're only using electrical energy coming from your solar cells to do that operation. That is a non-consumable. See, when you're using rocket power with your reaction control jets, you're consuming some kind of fluid that's in a storage tank on board Hubble, and you can only do that for a certain number of blasts, and then you're out of fuel. But when you're doing it electronically with these inertial wheels, you can see how you're only using the electrical power gathered by the solar cells. In theory, you can do it forever as long as the inertial wheels don't fail. But as you know, on both the Kepler Space Telescope and the Hubble Space Telescope, we've had failures of those inertial wheels. And so it's a difficult item to make work well for a long period of time, because in the case of inertial wheels, you are creating large amounts of torque. You're taking something that's very large, very heavy. The Hubble Space, let me drop it. The Hubble Space Telescope is about as big as a school bus. And to take something that big and steer it to some other point in space by using a mechanism that's only a foot or two in diameter, you're putting a lot of torque into that machine. You're putting a lot of force onto its bearings, and as such, it's only a matter of time before you get bearing wear and you get a failure. So that has been an item of a little bit of grief in the space program. And now that they're coming up with techniques where you steer little vanes on the end of your rocket so that the solar wind pushes against those vanes and therefore does the steering for you, although it's a slow method of steering, potentially it has a lot higher reliability. KC2WGB, K2IW with a bunch of opinions. I'm not an expert in this area.
KC2WGB. Dick, do you know, was that used on Viking, that system? By any chance?
I think they would have to use something equivalent. Viking was the spacecraft that landed on the surface of Mars roughly 1977, as I remember. There's a Viking 1 and a Viking 2. And so for them to know where that spacecraft is with reference to inertial space, in other words, where is it with reference to Mars, the Sun, the Earth, and so on, it'd have to be something like a gyro to do it. Now, so, did they have gyroscopes on board? Absolutely. Did they have inertial wheels on Viking? There, I'm doubtful. I think Viking, in its landing sequence, really used reaction control jets, is my guess. When we get the poll, we're going to get the final answer on that one. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Oh, Dick, WSTY.
Very good, Dick. Okay, we'll go over to Paul. Also, Voyager, I don't know if they were used on Voyager, but maybe that was too long ago. Was that 30 years ago? But, okay, that's it from the mailbag. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
360 TV with a comment.
Okay, you're here much beyond the normal hours where you always tell us you leave at 9 o'clock. Glad you're a little bit here later. Go ahead, Hal.
I just wanted to mention gyroscopes are also used in general aviation and in aviation period, because the directional gyro in the aircraft works with a gyroscope principle, And what happens is when you have a magnetic compass in an aircraft and you're either climbing or decelerating or accelerating, you have a compass error. Acceleration, oscillation, so on and so forth. No other turning error. So what they do, they have a gyro compass, which about every 15 minutes, you set the gyro compass against the magnetic compass when you're flying straight and level, or even on takeoff with your runway heading. Let's say you have a runway of 21 or 19 or 7. 21 would be 210 degrees magnetic. 19 would be 190 degrees magnetic. On your takeoff run, you reach over, you set your DG. And then as you're climbing out, your compass is not presetted. You're not using your magnetic compass. You're using your directional gyro compass for your headings. That's my only comment, Dick. I wanted to throw that in. K6DPT.
A HAL on a well-working gyro compass on an aircraft like yours. Make a guess for me. Roughly what is the drift rate of that gyro compass? How often must it be reset in flight in order to bring it back to a true reading? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
I do it about every 10 to 15 minutes when it starts to precess.
So I think you're telling me that the gyro compass on a private aircraft, like a Cessna aircraft, if you're an exacting type person, you might want to reset it every 15 minutes. And I'm of the opinion that the gyro compasses that are used on some of the NASA spacecraft have a much, much longer reset requirement, if you know what I mean. If I spent a whole lot of money buying my gyro compass for my Cessna aircraft, would I be able to buy one that has a lower drift rate than what you're describing, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Possibly. See, the whole thing is, when you set the DG to the magnetic compass, you have to be flying straight and level and not accelerating or decelerating at a constant rate, because the rest, you're not taking an accurate setting on the DG. And I imagine the DG that has, let's say, a faster running gyro would hold its accuracy for a longer period of time. I went slow on that, though. On every 15 minutes, at straight level flight, I readjust the DG.
When you readjust it every 15 minutes, are you moving at 2 degrees or 20 degrees is question number one. Question number two, where is the rotary energy coming from? Is there a pitot tube picking up flight air, spinning that gyro, or is it an electric motor? K16PZ, K2LIW.
Newer ones are electric motors. The earlier ones utilize a pitot tube or a vacuum pump to generate enough vacuum to have the jet spinning.
And in your typical flight, when you reset it every 15 minutes, are you moving at 2 degrees to reset it, or are you moving at 20 degrees to reset it? Give me a rough guess on that one, Hal. Go ahead.
About 2 or 3 degrees, depending on, you know, I'm looking at my magnetic compass, and I have a vertical magnetic compass, so it's a little more stable than the alcohol compass.
Okay, 2 or 3 degrees of resetting every 15 minutes. That gives me a warm and fuzzy. If it was 20 degrees, then I'd be a little bit of the opinion that the design could be improved. Good enough. Now, tell us about the inertial wheels and the gyro compasses and the in the case of a gyro compass, there are people who used to make a joke in what's called pidgin German, the inertial navigating system, inertial sensitive navigating system, people would call it Das Stargazing Steuerungswerks. So tell us a little bit about this, Paul. WS2N with a space report. I'm guessing this is space report number 115 or something like that. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Well, yeah, I have different numbers than you. Big difference. I'm up to 130, 132 or something. But, they did have all kinds of gyros inertial wheels on the orbiters for Viking. Viking was, you know, they were, it was really like four spacecraft, two that landed and two that went into orbit. actually, the orbiters have it. And now they have new gyros. They use gyroscopes. They use vibration with a piezoelectric type of thing. And it vibrates, stays in one direction, and they have electronic pickups coming off of it. And of course, this vibration stays in one plane. It's sort of like a bell ring. The bell really changes its shape as it rings. It kind of stays in one position. Piezoelectric setup. That's what they'll use in the future. Cassini has it, and James Webb Space Telescope will have it as well. Before we go onto the space portion of the net, anything else on these gyros?
Yeah, the vibrating piezoelectric finger inside of that kind of a gyro. Believe it or not, many of us got those inside of our cell phone. Many of the cell phones or pallet-like things, when you take the screen and it's set in a horizontal mode, and you rotate the screen 90 degrees, so now you're looking at the picture in the vertical mode, and you'll notice that the electronics inside readjust itself as you rotate the item. That's done with one of these inertial gyro systems. That's a rotating, that's a piezoelectric finger wiggling back and forth at a megahertz rate, roughly. I don't know the exact number. And that's how it senses. So there really is a gyro inside of our modern-day digital assistant that we carry. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Quick question for Eric, if he's still there.
You got it, John.
Oh, yeah.
Eric, that monitor we were speaking of, is that recognized one volt input, one volt peak-to-peak video signal? Is that what it's looking for?
Negative. It does not look for a analog video signal, which is one volt peak-to-peak with the sync and all that stuff. It is looking for something that's actually anywhere between, it works between 0.75 and 4 volts. But the actual real operating voltage, I think, is about 2.2 volts. And it's a digital stream. If you look at it on a scope, it just looks like noise.
Okay, thank you. Very good. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Paul.
And I can't leave the gyroscope topic without mentioning Sperry's gyroscope on Long Island. Oh, boy. Right next to Lakeville Road, right on the border of Queens and Nassau County. Huge complex. Probably did more for gyroscopes and the war effort and everything than anywhere else in the country, I would think. Very gyroscope. Yeah, Dick, I wanted to talk about the Dragon's spacecraft is now successfully attached to the International Space Station. It's the fifth paid flight for SpaceX to do that, to bring up a little over 5,000 pounds of supplies. But it's the sixth time that they've actually docked to the space station. The first one was a freebie. That was a test. NASA needed SpaceX to prove that. So that's why it is. This is mission five, but it's really the sixth time that they've docked with them. And the same thing with Orbital Science when the Cygnus spacecraft docked. The first one was not a paid visit. And each company is getting, $1.5 billion or a little bit more than that, I think, in some cases, to do these flights, 12 flights for SpaceX and 8 flights for Orbital Science. So I know you're always interested in how many flights go up to the space station, Dick, when you drop it. So I did some research, and I did find information saying that this is the 74th cargo ship to visit the complex. and overall, including all the space shuttles, 155 visits to the space station between cargo and spacecraft that are crewed. 155 flights. It's an amazing effort. So now you know you can take your estimate of just take a wild guess, 5,000 pounds for every flight, and you can multiply that times 74 unmanned flights plus all the space shuttles that went up there, and if you want to include the weight of the space station itself, you know, about 1 million pounds. There's a lot of stuff up there, Dick, and it's got to last a long, long time. So I found that for you. You know, that's a popular topic, you know. And how many more to do? Well, right now the space station is officially complete. I mean, they are going to add a couple of little modules here and there. But and how old is it? It started 17 years ago, really. Back in, what, 1998, they put their first piece up there. They've been putting them up ever since. It officially was completed in 2011. And, you know, the space shuttle did their job, brought all these modules up there, all the truss sections with all the photo cells, quite a deal. So I think something like $100 billion to put the space station up there, and they plan on running it to now 2024. And they plan on extending that visit, visiting to the space station well beyond that if they get funding for it. So the only thing that would shorten the life of the space station will be funding. And they can bring up, you know, repairs, supplies, they've been doing it for years anyway, ammonia pumps have failed, or all kinds of problems. So maintain it. It just costs money, and a lot more flights. They did have an ammonia leak this week, or what they thought was an ammonia leak. An alarm went off, and they had to abandon the American portion of the space station to go over to the Russian portion of the space station, close the doors at Unity. They closed it there. That divides the Russian side from the American side. So the half a dozen modules on one side, plenty of room to keep the six astronauts temporarily until they figured out what the problem was. Their whole space station is equivalent to a five-bedroom house. There's plenty of room and plenty of food for now. The cargo ships that keep coming up will continue to do that. There's one that's going to disconnect soon, the ATV, Automatic Transit Vehicle. That was the European Space Agency's deal for bringing up cargo. And that was quite large. That would be launched by the Ariane 5 rocket. And this was the fifth one, roughly one every year. And they're going to deorbit that now. They put a lot of junk in it. That burns up over the Pacific. And the ATV, usually they'll control it and burn it up right away as fast as they could going into the atmosphere. This time they're going to put it on more of a shallow angle sway. They're going to monitor it. There's going to be, you know, like hundreds of cameras watching this from all over, including cameras on board the ATV itself, and going to collect a lot of data. The ATV is large. It's a very large spacecraft. And through all this information they're going to get from it, they're going to, you know, extrapolate that to the size of an international space station. And they're going to get some information on someday. They're going to have to do the same thing to the space station. And they want good, you know, practical information on how they're going to exactly go ahead and do that. So ATV will have a second life science to figure out the burn process of something coming through the atmosphere with high accuracy. Even to the very end, the ATV will be doing the science. Let me drop it. A couple of other topics, they did test the new engine for the SLS, the Space Launch System. This is the system that will put the Orion spacecraft with four people on board, eventually onto lunar orbit, onto asteroids, and even onto Mars. It's going to require not three, but four old style, but, you know, modernized RS-25 engines, the same engines that were used on a space shuttle. Looking back at the space shuttle, it was actually, you know, it was like five engines. Two on the top were Ohm's engines, orbital maneuvering system engines. But the ones that launched the space shuttle, that would fire from the launch pad, the three large engines. Each one was an RS-25 hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, reusable engine. And of course, they had solid boosters to assist. Well, they're going to use those same engines, the same design of those engines. In fact, they're going to build new ones for the SLS system. And they tested one in Mississippi down at Stennis. That's where they do all these testing. And it went off perfectly last week. They fired it up for 500 seconds. And the idea is to increase the thrust of the old system. Yeah, space shuttle engines were, you know, a little bit less than 500,000 pounds thrust each. The new system will be, they need to get about, you know, 10-20% more out of it, like 520,000 pounds of thrust. And of course, instead of having three, they're going to put four. One time they were thinking about five, but they decided that it would be better to increase the thrust capability of each one and just go with four. Get the same results as having five. Now, these are throwaway engines. Space shuttle, they used to naturally land the space shuttle and refurbish the engines and relight them for the next launches. These are going to be throwaway engines, which is a shame, but that's the way it's going to be. So, and they officially renamed it to a RS-25D. The original ones are called RS-25s for the shuttle. And with SpaceX, X is launched, like I mentioned earlier, to the space station. They had, we talked about on the net, the idea of bringing the booster back to autonomous spaceport, you know, floating in the ocean, a big barge the size of a football field. And I know we talked about the results last week, but now there's further results. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of this rocket from the cameras on board the barge and how it came down and, you know, crashed onto the deck. It's still pretty impressive to get this thing from out of space, really. I mean, it was 60 miles up, which is really to the space, and bring it down to this little dot in the ocean, and with the legs open and everything. Next time around, they're going to do better, probably, and really try to land it onto the spaceport. They ran out of hydraulic fuel. So, as it was coming down, it was really not coming down as straight as they wanted it, and kind of like oscillating. And by the time it got right near the ship, the engine fired again to try to correct itself. But it was, by then it was too late, but it sort of slammed onto the barge. Went crossing right over the barge, some pieces came off. A lot of it went into the drink, but I don't know, I consider that a very good success. But they've got a lot of tries left even for this year to do it. We got
got one flight at the end of the month. It was going to go off the 29th. It's going to go off the 31st now this month. But they're going to try this again. This flight there, SpaceX, again, launching the Falcon 9. And they're going to bring up what used to be called Triad, and now it's called Discover. They renamed it. I know I mentioned this last week, but for those that didn't hear it, Triana was a planned mission back 12, 15 years ago, and supposed to go up in probably, I don't know, maybe 2000, in that area, maybe 1999, but they canceled the mission, and they put it in a garage, a clean room, and stored it away, and renamed it Discover, and the idea of Triana was to put it at the L1 position. That's 1 million miles, or just short of 1 million miles, between the Earth and the Sun. It'll stay there looking and staring at the Earth, taking pictures 24 hours a day, and looking at the weather. That was the idea of Triana. But that didn't occur, so they're going to send it up. They renamed it, and they just put more equipment on board, solar reading equipment. They're check the solar winds and what's coming off the sun. It'll do double duty with the ACE spacecraft that's presently located at that location. It's probably been there for 15 years and it's getting a little tired. And this will actually replace the ACE spacecraft eventually when that one fails. And if all goes well, SpaceX will try again to bring that first stage down and landed on the barge at the end of the month. And they have so many flights going up. I found a website that shows the next, I guess it's got to be 12, 15 flights for the rest of the year, and each one, what they're going to be taking up. You can click on that and find out what each satellite is. It's a good little website that you can go to. And I shorted it for everybody if they wanted to go to tinyurl.com/ MEOW37W. So tinyurl.com/ Mike Echo Oscar Whiskey 37 Whiskey. So that's the deal. And I said 17 years, by the way, on what was it, the spaceship, the space station. I just want to reiterate that most of this space station is new. This was completed in 2011. So, you know, a lot of those parts are good to go for many years to come. Each one was built for a minimum of 15 years use, each module that went up. There's a bunch of them. We've named them many times on the net. If anybody ever wants to hear them again, or you can look up the configuration on the computer as well. It's a pretty amazing piece of work. That's pretty much it for now, Dick. Have more next week. Let me drop it. If anyone wants to contact me, ask questions, I can be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick. Any questions or anybody else with comments? K2RIW, TechNet, WS2M.
Hi, thank you, Paul. And I do have a couple of questions. In the case of solar observing, SOHO did a lot of that for a lot of years and then had a couple of minor failures. I have the impression from what you've just told us that ACE took over for SOHO, and now Triana is going to take over for ACE. So give me the sequence between SOHO, ACE, and Triana. I presume these are all solar observatories, but here I'm not sure. WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh, yeah, of course, you know, SOHO is solar, and so is ACE. They're both out at the L1 position. And I call it Triana. I'm really wrong in doing that. That was the original name for it. And now it's called Discover. because they renamed it. Triana was the original name. They got that name from, Columbus. Everybody says, oh, Columbus discovered America. Well, it was the guy up in the crow's nest. Oh, there it is. His name was Triana, so that's where that came from. And now it's Discover. And that has two purposes. It's a solar observatory, like what you're saying there. But it does double duty. It's a weather satellite. It's being sent up, paid for by NOAA. It's not a NASA. It doesn't come under the NASA bill. It comes under the NOAA bill. And, of course, it's SpaceX that's putting it up. Back to you.
Now, has SOHO stopped operating completely, or is it still being used? Is ACE in the middle of its lifetime? Has Discover just about to be launched, or what is the status of Discover? And will it be making other kinds of solar measurements, space weather measurements, that are higher in resolution than the previous two spacecraft? A bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, it's solar wind and the main thing that it's a early warning detection machine. I mean, that's the main purpose of this thing, and that's very similar to what ACE is doing too. So you got a coronal mass ejection, all sorts of stuff coming toward the Earth. This will pick it up. And you got it. Now it hit the deck, I guess, it's going to be a million miles out. These things go roughly a million miles an hour. So it'll give us some time to turn our spacecraft, shut them down, or do something, some kind of protection mode. That's basically what ACE was doing, and so was this Discover mission. Discover, yeah, that's the one going up at the end of the month. It was supposed to go up the 29th. Actually, the dates keep shifting. But it was going to go up the 29th, and now it's the last day of the month. It's the 31st. And that's pretty much it, Dick. That's the one that we're going to hope that SpaceX succeeds and brings its booster back on. At first, when I heard that they're going to go out to the L1 position, I didn't think that they were going to be able to put landing legs on this one. Because when they send up a spacecraft to the geosynchronous orbit, they've done that at least two times before. They're very heavy spacecraft, and they need all the power from the Falcon 9 to do it. But this is the lightest spacecraft. It's medium weight. So my guess is it takes a lot of fuel to get it out four times the distance of the moon. They know they have enough fuel on board to do the three burns. This thing's going 3,000 miles an hour. After it separates from the second stage, it puts it, the second stage puts the spacecraft out to the L1 position. But this thing, this boost is going to come back. It doesn't burn to slow it down and start bringing it back. And then when it gets halfway down, it'll burn again to straighten itself out. And then it's got enough fuel on board. One more rocket engine burns at the very last couple of seconds to land on the barge. Originally, you have nine rockets that push this thing up on the first stage. Three rockets are igniting to slow it down, also to slow it down the second time. And at the very end, there's one rocket down in the middle that reignites to try to land it safely on the barge. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting. 9, 3, and 1. And it sounds to me like Discover is not quite as heavy as some of the craft that are being put into geosynchronous orbit, because geosynchronous orbit is, I guess, roughly a tenth of the way between the Earth and the Moon, and the Discover L1 position is four times the lunar distance. You would think to go that greater distance requires greater thrust. I'm guessing Discover must be lighter than some of the things that are put into synchronous orbit. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do all that extra boosting. I'm guessing you're going to go straight, that Discover is going to go straight to the L1 position. It's not going to do any flybys to boost energy of any other celestial object to get there. Is that true, Paul? K2LIW?
I missed the summaries. I missed part of it. I think one of my potentiometers just cracked out there. What, what were we talking about? Repeat the question, Dick.
In order to have enough boosting power for Falcon 9 to put something in geosynchronous orbit, you got to make it as light as possible because it's a lot of energy requirement. But geosynchronous orbit is only one-tenth of the distance to the Moon. This Discover is going to go to the L1 position, which is 10 times further away than the Moon. You would first think that's going to take a lot more boost power. Unless the launch procedure for Discover uses gravity assist by flying by some other celestial object, like Venus, which I somehow doubt. So it's beginning to make me think that Discover must be a lighter payload than a geosynchronous orbit payload. WS2N, K2LIW.
It's definitely smaller, so I don't know what its weight is, but some of these geosynchronous things are huge. But, I did see what it looked like, and I'd say it's probably, it's got to be one-third the size of, maybe smaller than, probably less than one-third the size of the Tejas satellite. Now, for instance, the next flight going up, I think next week, is going to be launched by an Atlas V rocket. It's a full configuration, 551 setup, and that's going to be putting a Navy communication satellite into geosynchronous orbit. And this is it's actually the heaviest piece of equipment that the Atlas V has ever put into a geosynchronous orbit. It's a very big, heavy satellite. You can see it, they have pictures of guy working on it. You can see the size of him compared to the size of his spacecraft in the clean room. And it's big. And it must be heavy. I don't know what the weight is. It's like a military type satellite, so I don't think all the details are there. But the picture was there, and I can tell you that it's a big satellite. And if it's going up in a 551 configuration, a lot of people don't know what that means. This is the Atlas 5551. Let me drop it. You could have, for instance, an Atlas 5451, for instance, but or 431, or one of the numbers. The first number, it's always three numbers, In this case, it's 551, so first number is the meters in diameter of the fairing. Fairing is the piece of equipment that's surrounding the spacecraft at the top of the rocket. And in this case, the 5, so it's a 5-meter diameter of fairing. And the second 5 that they use means how many booster rockets are attached. So in this case, there'll be 5. And then the 1 stands for how many rockets are attached to the second stage. In this case, 1. That's what the 551 means. In fact, this 551 was also used, I think it was only used 3 other times. And one of the times it was used was for the New Horizon going to Pluto. And that was the fastest thing that has ever left the face of the Earth. That thing left at fantastic speed. For instance, to get to the equivalent of where the moon is, a quarter of a million miles out, drop it. I have to mention this, is the Apollo spacecraft used to take, what, three and a half, four days to actually get to the moon, you know, 3.5 days. New Horizon, when it left the Earth, it could have gotten to the moon if it was going there in 9 hours. So, when the Atlas V has a 5-5-1 configuration, although the, it was, you know, I think they used the 4-5-1. It was a 5-5-1 for the New Horizon. But, you know, that's a lot of power. I forget how many millions of pounds of thrust. But that's the biggest thing we have. Most powerful setup we have. Atlas V. You know, even more powerful than that Delta IV the Delta IV Heavy that launched the Orion spacecraft. So, quite a setup. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, this launch of the Navy satellite will be an Atlas 551 that makes it sound like it's a two-stage boost. I thought it's a three-stage function. In other words, the first stage is the one that comes back. Therefore, it sounds like that stage is suborbital. In order to put something in geosynchronous orbit, you really got to first get into a parking orbit. You're really into a low-Earth orbit position. And so your first booster is not going to get you there, is my belief. And then that one booster that gets you all the way up to geosynchronous orbit, I think it's called the Apogee Kick motor. But I thought most of these launches are done with three stages. Your current description makes me think it's only two stages. Is there a missing stage there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, yeah, you've got the boosters, the five solid boosters that are attached. You've got the main booster itself, the Atlas V, which is RD 180 kerosene liquid oxygen engine, and then you have on top of that, I don't know which one they use. I know they run two different types of on the what I call the second stage. I believe that's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine made by Aerojet. So, and then there is, I think, another kicker motor on the little spacecraft itself, on the final piece that goes up to geosynchronous orbit. But that second stage will get you there. The liquid oxygen one. You know, don't forget you got five solid boosters helping this thing to go. Back to you, Dick.
The very last stage, the Apogee Kick motor, is that a solid state, Paul?
In this case, I really don't know. I don't know. It's tough when they put these military flights up. They don't have all that many details, you know. They got the Atlas V. So I know there's one, you know, it's the 551. That means that one means there's one engine. I mean, if there were two engines hooked to that one stage, it would be a 552. There's never been one, never been a flight with that configuration. It's in planning. It's still planning to do something like that, but it's never happened yet. Back to you, Dick.
Do you know the approximate thrust of an Atlas V in the 5 configuration? Are we talking about something close to 5 million pounds?
I don't know. I know I don't want to give you information because the solid boosters throw it all off. I think each one of them, 300, 400 pounds or something. I forget what it is. Some large number. You get a lot of power out of it, so I'll boost the rockets. But there is an order of supremacy. Atlas V is biggest thing we have. Then the Delta IV and the Delta II. And of course, then you get your Falcon 9. That's in another category of wars, you know, in itself. That's, it's easy enough to find right now. I don't know offhand what the thrust is on that, but it was enough to push New Horizon past the moon. But I read that years ago. And don't forget that was 9 years ago that thing launched, and then the Atlas V, with the five solids pushed it past the moon's orbit in 9 hours. Wow! Back to you, Dick.
Therefore, making a comparison to Apollo seems appropriate. Yes, the Apollo had a whole lot of life-sustaining stuff for the astronauts and their separate capsule, so it's not a good comparison, but I think the Apollo launch vehicle, which I think was called Saturn V, I think you told me it's got around something like 7.5 million pounds of thrust. The Atlas V right now is the biggest thing we own. Do you think its thrust on takeoff is in the same order of magnitude of the Apollo Saturn V, WS-2N, K2LAW?
The Saturn V was, you're right, 7.5 million pounds of thrust. But I noticed the Atlas V is much less than that. Yeah, the numbers for, what is it? I'm trying to think of it. The Delta IV Heavy. Delta IV Heavy was 4.5 million pounds. That's the one that just launched the Orion spacecraft. So I'm pretty sure it's probably in that category. Now looking it up, I don't know. So, at one time they thought about making an Atlas Heavy. That would have been three Atlases bolted together. Just like later this year, you're going to have a Falcon Heavy takeoff from Florida, Cape Canaveral. That's going to be three Falcon 9s bolted together. just a point of interest, when I said earlier that if a Falcon 9 puts a spacecraft into geosynchronous orbit, which it's done at least two times before, if they don't have enough fuel to bring the rocket back, their goal is eventually to develop the Heavy, because everything's going to be reusable. So they want to launch the Heavy, which is three Falcon 9s, and they'll put the same satellites that they're putting up now, even heavier ones, into geosynchronous orbit, and then they want to bring all three boosters back and land them at the Cape. And by the way, they have clearance now, eventually.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Instead of going onto a barge once they succeed with that, and the FAA gives them clearance, they've already got the permission, or might say renting out the space for Launch Complex number 13, which hasn't been used since the late 1970s at the Cape. And that, so it'll be launched from Launch Complex 40. It'll put a spacecraft up into orbit, and they'll bring it back to Launch Complex 13 down in Florida. They got big plans, this SpaceX thing.
To my knowledge, the heaviest geosynchronous objects put up for NASA are the TGS satellites, Tracking Data Relay Satellite System, and there's at least three or four of those in orbit every 120 degrees around the equator, so you get continuous coverage of a spacecraft that's in orbit around the Earth by way of TGS, or very close to complete coverage. I am guessing that this Navy geosynchronous communication satellite is going to have something that is similar in design and similar in size to a Tetris. That's a guess on my part, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, what I saw in that clean room looking at the picture, I mean, it looked, I don't know, it looked bigger than that. It was a big thing, but I'm not sure. But they did say it's the heaviest thing the Atlas put up, so it might, you know, in size or weight, at least they said heaviest, so it's the mass anyway is the heaviest thing. So that makes it heavier than the Tetris. Tetris has been launched by Atlas rockets. The original plans was to launch the earliest Tetris satellites with the space shuttle. That didn't work out. In fact, the one that blew up, Challenger, had a Tetris on board. So, after that, you know, they needed these satellites, so they went with expendable rockets. Forget about the shuttle. Back to you, Dick.
When you looked at this Navy communication satellite and said it's very large, are you describing its deployed solar cells, or are you describing its deployed parabolic dish antenna system, or just the body of the spacecraft itself? And maybe the solar cells are on the body of the spacecraft. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, this is without the solar cells opened up. I mean, it looked like it was 40 feet wide, about 20 feet high. It was, I don't know what it was, but I guess that this must have been, it sure wasn't in its folded up configuration. They were working on it. So they got to fold it up and get it within this 5-meter diameter bearing on top of this. Top of Atlas V. So we'll see. And the Atlas V's got these RD-180 engines, very powerful engines. I think they're 900. I remember reading over 900,000 pounds of thrust on those engines. But see, that doesn't count the five. I got to look up what the solids are, but that doesn't count the solid booster rockets. One of them, you know, might be 200,000 pounds or something. I don't know, but I know the Atlas itself, the RD-180s, which are eventually going to be replaced, by the way, Boeing and Lockheed, which make up the United Launches Alliance that launches all these rockets. They launch the Delta IVs, the Delta IIs, and the Atlas Vs. Have made a deal with Blue Origin to build their rockets. They'll have them within about 4 years, called the BE-4, and they're not going to be RP-1 fuel or essentially purified kerosene. It's not going to be the same as what they use on these rockets on the Atlas V, but it's going to be
repeater timeout cancel.
With, of course, liquid oxygen. That's going to be real different and more powerful than the 180 that they use now, the RG-180. Back to you, Dan.
When it comes to fancy space calculations, one of the things I was reading recently is the Oberth effect, O-B-E-R-T-H. This man, Hermann Oberth, he lived up until 1989, born in 1894. A space expert as far as predicting what the future would be like. And he came up with an interesting concept that at first people thought it was wrong, and it turned out he's dead right. Let me drop it. And that is, I'm going to give you two examples. Let's assume you and I are testing a rocket engine on the ground, and we're measuring its thrust. And we get X number of pounds of thrust out of it. But since it's on a ground stand and it doesn't move anything, the amount of kinetic energy or the amount of momentum it has given to our spacecraft is zero because it didn't move. Or by By the same token, if you hover with a spacecraft, you're getting no change in momentum and no change in kinetic energy. Therefore, since kinetic energy is a function of force through a distance, a joule of energy is a certain amount of force, a newton meter, a newton of force exerted through a distance of 1 meter is the definition of 1 joule, and it's also 1 watt second. Let me drop. So therefore, the faster a spacecraft is moving when it gives you the thrust, the more energy it's putting into your spacecraft. Now, when you put that together with a flyby, say for instance you're flying Voyager, and you're doing a flyby of Jupiter in order to get a gravity assist, and assume now you're also going to do a little bit of rocket burning because the gravity assist is not enough. Well, as you approach Jupiter to do the flyby, as you get closer and closer to Jupiter, you're being drawn into the group Jupiter's gravity, and your velocity is increasing. After you pass by Jupiter, Jupiter's gravity is going to slow you down, and you'll be decreasing in velocity. If you're going to do the burn when you're at the closest point of Jupiter, when you're at maximum velocity. Therefore, the same amount of thrust out of your rocket engine gives you more energy coupled into your spacecraft. At first, it doesn't make common sense until you start looking into the details. And Mr. Oberth, way back somewhere around 1920 or 1930, predicted if we used rocket engines in this manner, we'd get the maximum efficiency out of them. I wonder if you've ever heard that one before, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, they've done that recently with the Grail missions to the moon. The Lottie missions that Orbital Science launched using the Minotaur 5. That was a five-stage, all solid boosters, all solid rocket engines. That was a five-stage rocket that launched from Wallops Island. They would do that. They would actually orbit. It would actually orbit the Earth, and then at the slowest point, another rocket would fly. That type of thing. The Indian government did it with the MOM spacecraft, the Mars orbiter mission that they launched to Mars successfully and got it into Mars orbit. I don't know how many orbits it did of Earth. I think probably about 7 or 8 orbits, and each time at its perigee, it would ignite another blast, and that's how they got out of the gravity well of Earth. So they used that quite a bit. Back to you, Dick.
Because of this Oberth effect, the higher the velocity of your spacecraft when you do the burn, or in the case of a jet engine, a turbojet, turbo ramjet, the higher your velocity when you get that thrust, the more energy you're getting. The bottom line of this is that the engine on the SR-71 spacecraft, it's almost a spacecraft, it flies at numbers like 85,000 feet and Mach 3.2. You get the greatest number of miles per gallon when that engine is burning full afterburner at Mach 3.2 at 85,000 feet. Crazy engine. Therefore, it gives you a specific impulse of 3,100, which I think is almost the same specific impulse you get out of the ionic engine that was used recently. Let me drop. And so that J-58 engine on the SR-71 surveillance reconnaissance spacecraft. Not a spacecraft, you know what I mean, aircraft, air-breathing aircraft. When it's cranking at full altitude, at full velocity, not only do you get a specific impulse of 3,100, but you're getting something like a third of a million horsepower out of each one of those engines. And you're shooting a flame out the back that's probably 100 feet long, and the flame is coming out of that engine at around Mach 6. That's an engine. That thing has got the hair on its chest, Paul. WS2N, K2RAW.
WS2N. The website I gave out before, one of the missions coming up.